Mini episode 44 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
All right, welcome to another mini episode of the FDH Lounge. Rick Morris and Mike Ptak coming at you here. Mike Ptak, our FDH Chief Motorsports Correspondent. Good to have you back in as always, pal. How you doing?
It's been a while, Ricky. How you doing?
Yeah, real good. It's been a long time. Long time no broadcast together.
And, absolutely.
We're here tonight, notwithstanding the early chuckles here. Very sad occasion, and that is what we're going to be commemorating here tonight. The life and times of Dan Weldon and everything that went along with that. Dan Weldon, actually, FDH Lounge guest in the past. The first of our guests, I believe, to have passed away, and one of the younger ones, which just really makes it a fluke. It just shows you how random life can truly be. That was the last of the episodes we did when we were at the Sports Talk Network. That very vaunted Ted Williams home run in the final at bat there as we ended our run at the place. Dan Weldon, Road Warrior Animal, Gaylord Perry on that night, and just, you know, looked back on that night with such fondness and such, you know, great thoughts about that great run of guests that we had on that night. And then just now, the shock and the sorrow, I think it's only really starting to pass some weeks later. But what a delightful guy to get to talk to, such a tremendous guy to agree to come on mere days after winning his second Indianapolis 500 and winning it in real underdog fashion as he did without even a regular ride this year. But it was something. You and I talked on the phone that night when it happened, Mike, and we really couldn't believe what had happened.
It was terrible. It was just so sad. You saw that accident. You just knew it wasn't good. From the very instant that you saw that car just go over the top of another car and just go against that fence, you just knew, you know, something really, really tragic was going to come out of this. And absolutely the worst case scenario came out. You know, Dan Weldon, just a tremendous individual. I mean, you're hard-pressed to find anyone to ever say an unkind word about that man. And it even showed when you had him on the show, he was just so, you know, gracious and grateful just to even, you know, have the time for you to want to interview him. And it was just, you know, something that I'm always going to take from that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so impressed by the guy because, again, you know, when you look at the media ecosystem, again, he's a lot bigger than us. The Dan Weldon name, a lot bigger than the FDH Lounge. And it's a thing where, again, we're used to getting big time by a lot of people. We chase a lot of big fish. We get a fair number of them. But we also get big timed a lot. And I always look at it like, who the hell are you to big time us when Dan Weldon can make time for us or Bob Barker or somebody? And, you know, a lot of times, you know, people aren't even nice about it or people are duplicitous about it or whatever, versus a Dan Weldon who was just very nice and kind about it and came on and had a great conversation with us. That's my regard for the man. I had regard for him before that, but that says a lot about the man. When you're a lot bigger than somebody else and you treat them with that kind of kindness and graciousness as he did, Mike. I mean, I think that is, and that's one of the reasons I wanted people to hear that interview. We had it up on YouTube right about at that point in time. I wanted people to hear it and experience it because, like you said, what better way to get a sense of what the man was all about than in that conversation?
Absolutely, and it was, you know, two-time Indianapolis 500 champion. Amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and here was a guy without a ride, a full-time ride. He got a ride, you know, a part-time ride this year. He wins the Indianapolis 500, and, you know, boom, you know, you're able to get him on the show. And you always admire Dan Weldon as a driver. Mm-hmm. You listen to the man. You spend time on the phone with the man interviewing, and your level of respect just goes through the roof.
Yeah, what a tremendous guy, and he really broke down everything that he was doing and going through very well. It was a unique time in his life When we spoke to him, his wife had not yet given birth to his second son, who was born this summer. And he did, again, he got to spend more time with his family, at least, this summer, which in retrospect is a tremendous blessing that he was at least able to get to do that and experience the time that he did there. None of us knew at the time exactly how important that was going to be. But, yeah, he ends up without a ride this year. There's only a few top-level rides. We talked about it in our last NASCAR discussion that we did, Mike, and it's the same thing, obviously, in open wheel. Probably even less top-level rides because the open wheel circuit has been less successful than NASCAR in recent years. He was holding out for the level of ride that was going to get him back in there in contention, not just racing again, but racing at the level to which he had become accustomed. And in the end, he got it. In the end, he signed papers on that last morning to race Danica Patrick's car next year.
Absolutely. He's going to race for Andretti Green, which is probably, you know, right now one of the two top teams there is in open wheel. Targa Ganassi and Andretti Green with Newman Haas really gone by the wayside right now.
I meant to talk about that with you as well, the Newman Haas situation. Andretti Green hasn't filled that seat yet, have they?
I don't believe they have, no.
And, okay.
You know, and now that I think about it, Rahal Letterman is getting back in an open wheel this year, so, you know, there may be a couple of seats that open up right there.
There may be as well. By the way, in the course of all of this, I think we want to send a shout out of appreciation here. Graham Rahal, I understand, this started from a Twitter campaign that he had started to try to raise money for Dan Weldon's family. I think it was a fund for his children, and it really kind of blew up from there. Drivers from big circuits all over the world ended up donating stuff. There was, I think, they got from eBay, I think, there was some auction space online that had been donated for it. And I understand a lot of money was raised. You had NASCAR, F1 drivers, as well as American Open Wheel who were donating things there. And, again, it all just stemmed from a tweet that Graham Rahal threw out there. He started it, and he ultimately ended up administering it. So we definitely want to congratulate him for a job well done on that.
Absolutely. You know, Ohio boy,
mm-hmm.
born and raised, and, you know, he should be very proud of himself. And, you know, the racing community, whether it's open wheel, whether it's NASCAR, whether it's F1, it's a very tight community.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll be rooting for Graham Rahal a lot from now on as a result of this. And when you look at everything that happened there, yeah, I mean, obviously with the Newman Haas drivers back on the market here because of that unfortunate circumstance, maybe one of them ends up in the seat there with the Andretti Green team. But it was a thing where I understand people look at this different ways, and I'm not going to fault anybody for how they choose to look at a circumstance like this because it's very difficult, and we all deal with things in our own way. I chose to take inspiration from it, the notion that on the morning of that last race that Dan Weldon signed the papers, I believe it's been substantiated, that is what happened. He was going to race in the seat that Danica Patrick had next year as she's vacating to leave for NASCAR. Danica Patrick, ironically, her last full-time IndyCar race the same day as Dan Weldon, obviously the other end of the spectrum in terms of the circumstances of why it's the last day for her. But I choose to take inspiration from it, Mike, because when you listen to Dan and the conversation we had, he really seemed to be looking for the kind of vindication out there that, look, I'm a two-time now IndyCar champion, or, well, Indianapolis 500 champion. He also won the IndyCar Series in 2005, and his whole attitude seemed to be, look, I would like to be at a place that is commensurate with my achievements, a place that where I'm going to have a legitimate chance to go out there and win every week. And in the end, he got it back. I mean, he doesn't get to use it, obviously, but he got it back, and he had to climb into the car the last time that day feeling a tremendous amount of satisfaction. He lived long enough to sign those papers, and I'm at least glad for that.
Absolutely, and not that Dan was coming off being cocky.
No.
Because that wasn't the case at all.
No.
It's just that he has...
Competitive.
He had a certain level of expectations that he wanted.
Yeah.
And he was going to hold out for nothing less.
Yeah. That's all you can do, Mike, because,
absolutely,
again, there's only a limited number. We've talked about this. There's only a limited number of seats really in any of the circuits, but especially in IndyCar. You know, it's finite. They've been through a lot the last 15 years with that stupid split that they went through. They reunited just in time for the worst economy since the Great Depression. So there's not a lot of great seats out there. And he's looking at it and he's saying, I don't want to waste my time. I've done this. I've accomplished it, you know, to a certain level here. I've earned the right to go out there and be in a situation that's going to give me a chance to win. Yeah, there's nothing cocky about that, Mike.
No, and he's you know, unlike some people, mm-hmm. he wasn't in it for the money.
No.
You know, granted, he wanted to be comfortable, but he wanted to be competitive. He wanted a race. He wanted to be competitive every week. And if you couldn't provide him with that type of ride, then, you know, he really wasn't interested.
No, nor should he have been, because, again, you are just wasting your time if you're not going to be out there in a car that has that kind of a chance. And we saw that this year. He could have raced a lot more. If he would have just kind of settled here, so to speak. And I don't mean in the case of any of this to disparage any of those teams that are out there, but it's the same type of thing. In a free market system, Mike, it's the same thing. You'll look in baseball. You don't expect an Albert Pujols to go take the amount of money that the San Diego Padres are offering. And again, it's not a money-type situation, but it's also competitiveness. Albert Pujols isn't going to make enough of a difference on the Padres to be able to win, and it's the same thing in racing. Dan Weldon, one of the greatest open-wheel racers in the world, and yet, if he's not in one of those finite number of seats, he's really going to have to scratch and overachieve just to be in the picture week after week.
Yeah, he could be a top 10 racer, mm-hmm. top 15 racer, but if he's in the finite, the top elite level of vehicle,
mm-hmm.
he has the potential to win every week.
Yeah. And ultimately, that's what it came down to. I'd like to talk about this as well with some of the media coverage of what came out afterwards, because you referenced this. You referenced how beloved that he was, and it's very interesting because that really was the case, particularly in the last couple of years. I had read some stuff about when he first came over that there were some people who didn't quite get him, and that the whole thing, again, as boisterous of a personality as he is, and many times in life this is mistaken for something else, that there may have been, and I saw that he had even kind of conceded this in some interviews, some people who maybe didn't get him the first couple of years, thought that he was brash or arrogant or whatever, which I have to believe was probably never the case. But the sense that I get of it is, we've all seen, I assume you've seen Vince Vaughn in Swingers, right?
Yes.
Okay. Have you ever seen much lesser known movie? Vince Vaughn in the movie Made. Did you ever see that one?
Have not.
Him and Jon Favreau in that one. And it's funny because in that movie, he plays a character, and I don't see much difference between that character and Double Down Trent, but it's like a mirror image thing. Like in that movie, everybody hated him. Everybody was like, what an a-hole. That guy, he's just, look at how stuck up he is and arrogant and whatever. And it's just a funhouse mirrors kind of a thing when you see both movies there. And I have to believe Dan Weldon was probably always the same guy. Maybe there's something to be said for later on. He did settle down. He got married. He had a family. That had a change in perspective, maybe, as it did for some people. But I thought it was a little bit of a bad rap from the media when they're talking about, this guy matured, this guy whatever. Well, how much did he even have to mature? How much of it was that maybe some people didn't just get him right off the bat, and maybe they did later? I mean, maybe he figured some things out, but maybe, you know, some people might have jumped to some conclusions earlier on.
Absolutely, and jealousy can rear its ugly
yes.
head. And when he comes in and he gets an A number one ride right off the bat, and there's other people who are fighting just to get a ride,
yeah.
automatically they're going to rub somebody, you know, they're not going to like whoever, in this case, Dan Weldon.
Yeah. You know, good-looking guy, charming, funny, and jealousy, as you said, might have been the case there. But it's good to see again. And again, I take heart from these things that, again, you have to find solace where you can find it in a situation like this. He got that ride back in the end. He got the universal respect and appreciation in the end. You didn't hear any of the drivers at that point in time. You know, and nobody's going to speak ill of the deceased, obviously, but there wasn't even any begrudging kind of thing I saw of like, well, I thought that, perhaps he was a bit unprofessional in some ways, but he was a great driver. No, there was none of that. There was none of that kind of stuff. Nobody was even passive-aggressive about it. Everybody saw him as being a great guy and really kind of the life of the IndyCar spirit in the end there. So I like what people were saying at the end. I just felt like it was a little bit of a double-edged sword, the way the media was sort of portraying it as far as his journey of stuff here. I mean, yeah, okay, maybe. I'd like to think that we all, me, you, and everybody else, as we go along, we get to be better and smarter and maybe don't repeat some of the same mistakes or whatever. But I just got the sense they portrayed that maybe as a little bit more than it was, and it might have been a little bit unfair to the earlier perception of him in IndyCar.
That's the media trying to make the story grander than it actually is, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so, because I think that was very much overblown. And it was only a small element, but it was one that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I actually didn't see this as it happened. I was slogging through another stupid Browns game that afternoon. I happened to flip over after the crash had happened, but the way you were talking about it before, did you see the crash as it happened?
I did not see it. I like you was watching, but there was a lull in the Browns game. They were sucking, I believe, at that point in time.
Go figure.
Who'd have thunk? And me and my dad, you know, we always spend our Sundays together, either watching football, baseball, NASCAR, open wheel racing, whatever. He's a huge fan like myself. And, you know, we just kept on seeing, you know, the red flag. We're like, well, what's going on? And then they kept on showing the crash, and they show the crash. Here's the slow motion. Here's the camera inside Dad Weldon's car. And I could just see his car was speeding up. And I don't know if Indy has not. Nobody's really addressed this, but to me, you look at the video, and it just looks like his car just speeds up. And I don't know if something went wrong, if the brake wasn't working or the accelerator stuck. You know, this is just me, you know, trying to be observant. You know, something definitely, you know, went haywire in that car, in my opinion.
Yeah, the way that it flew up there, you may very well be right. Your eyes were better able to catch that than mine, but it was really an unbelievable set of circumstances. It was a thing where it was weird, though, that even as they were replaying it afterwards, and even after they had, I guess I was in shock after they announced that he had passed away, but it was one of those things, and it was, again, all these things are weird. It didn't, in watching the whole thing, it wasn't quite like watching what happened to Dale Earnhardt, because that was isolated.
Right.
And it was a thing where, again, to me, I'm watching it, and past the first 3 seconds, it's all a jumble to me. I mean, the fact that everybody else was involved in it, it wasn't as traumatic for me to see, because then it's like, oh, that's just a giant, you know, like a 24-car pileup on the freeway. And I mean, and again, it's all just a matter of perspective. The one thing, though, you mentioned about the one shot in the car. And I had had a couple of our dignitaries, Nate Noy and Raymond Smalley, had complained to me that they had been subjected to that on TV. I guess CNN had even cut into something out of nowhere. They were not even talking about that story at the time, and then cut into it and showed you that angle of it. And the notion that you're watching the last few seconds of a man's consciousness, I haven't seen it, and at this point in time, I'm pretty sure I can escape it. I don't think it's going to be thrust upon me 6 weeks later as it was for them. I'm pretty sure I'll live the rest of my life escaping that, but I sympathize with them. I wouldn't want to see that. That must be horrible.
It was terrible. And then, you know, I understand that they're doing their job, and they're reporting, and you know, you're in a red flag situation for hours, and you got to try to fill time, and I understand that. And I'm pretty sure they had a good idea at the track what was going on, that it wasn't just a severe injury. And, you know, you keep on going back to these angles, and, you know, I'm sorry, but there just had to be, you know, you didn't have to show that in the car.
No, that was distasteful, and on the subject, I don't want to beat the distasteful elements to death, but I'm going to mention this as well here. ESPN on Monday night, it was a thing where when they were doing their Sports Center, they did their thing on Dan Weldon, and it was a nice tribute. I think it was the one that Jeremy Schapp had put together, and it was a really good one, and I'm critical of a lot of things of ESPN, but it was done very well. They did the whole thing, put the thing on the screen, Dan Weldon, you know, age whatever, you know, and fade to black. And then they come back in a second. Coming up tonight, Monday Night Countdown, as we're going to talk about Monday Night Football. Like, wow, you dirtbags couldn't even just do the whole fade to black, go to commercial thing. You got to get your Monday Night Countdown, Monday Night Football plugs in. I mean, That is something, and I have watched in vain to see if the Poynter Institute was going to address that as the quote-unquote ESPN ombudsman. Shockingly, nothing out of them. I thought that was just really, really, really poor taste. I'm sad that they would do something like that. Isn't that a universal thing in broadcasting? You fade to black, you go to commercial, you whatever. You don't try to get in one more cheap plug?
Yeah, you would think. And you think ESPN being at the top of their... They get critical acclaim for everything. You think that they would just, you know, you would know better. I thought for sure that's how it always is, you know. Rest in peace, fade to black, go to commercial.
Yeah. Yeah, that should not be the preamble for one more cheap plug about your stupid Monday night game. And I remember it was a bad Monday night game, too. I think that was Dolphins-Jets that week or whenever it was, but it was just really bad. But as far as what happened that day, you're talking about at the track, need to fill time, et cetera, like that. It was amazing how quickly these things were jumping up on Twitter. I don't know how much you saw of was happening there. Did you see that within a couple of minutes after the driver's meeting, Tony Kanaan comes out of there, they got the close-up on his face, and you could just tell. You could tell what it was. And then Tony Kanaan, in the blink of an eye, top 10 trending on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You knew. You knew when they all came out, and, you know, Kanaan was just, that was his buddy. That was his best friend. And, you know, he was just devastated. And, you know, it's really, you know, hindsight being 2020, a lot of the drivers came out afterwards and say, hey, you know what? This track going this fast with this many cars on it, it isn't safe. And there's probably quite a few tracks, Kansas, I believe they race at Iowa. You know, that are basically the same.
Don't forget Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is Open Wheel going to say, okay, wow, we have to look at this again? Are they going to try to slow down their cars like NASCAR did and put a restrictor plate on them? Are there going to be more road courses? You know, they've got a lot of things they got to get in order before next season even starts.
Yeah, and the guy that owns the Las Vegas track, I was reading today, was quoted as being impatient with the IndyCar review process and just a real, I don't want to say this, but I will, a real sort of hose off the blood and get it started again mentality, because it seems completely lost on him that a human life was lost on his track, and that you need to examine the possible causes behind that there. I was a little bit sad to see in the days after this when Jimmy Johnson was showing a little bit of a concern for really his brother drivers out there, albeit in another circuit, that there was a little bit of backlash against him. What do you know, NASCAR boy? You know, I'm looking at this like the health and safety of these guys has to be paramount. If there's anything to be learned from this, Mike, everything else should be put behind that. I didn't even realize before this, I thought F1 mostly raced road courses just out of tradition. Apparently, F1 races mostly road courses because they know that these things don't work on ovals so well.
Yeah, and, you know, that's why you very rarely see a lot of F1 drivers come over, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You had a few, you know, Nigel Mansell, you know, he was probably the most successful from F1 to come over here. Mm-hmm. And become successful on the oval. But you're right. You know, I mean, they're going 2.25, 2.30 on a mile and a half, you know, track. That I don't care what kind of safety barriers you have. You know, you could have the safer barrier, you can have whatever. When you're going that fast on that small of a track, it's just not safe.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about restrictor plates. At a bare minimum, it seems like, again, they've been the one circuit where it's no cap on speed, no cap on speed. It's early to say, but you know that whatever happens, this is going to be sort of like a Dale Earnhardt moment where they had the Hans device. There's always something that comes out of this. Is that not going to be probably the biggest thing that comes out of this? This is the end of no cap on speed? It would seem like that's the case.
If they don't put a cap on speed, they may have to say, look, minimum size for an oval, 2.5 miles.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's easier to do the cap on speed.
Absolutely.
Because then you don't get into a political situation with the Vegas track owner and everything else. So,
but being,
you know,
completely selfish, what would I like to see him to come back to Cleveland and race on the airport surface?
Absolutely. And I think it is going to lead to a better traction as far as road courses like that one out there, getting an in with IndyCar. It's very curious to me. I understand after the first year that the circuits reunited because they're looking at it like, okay, we don't have a whole lot of time. We got to, you know, slop this together here. But beyond that, to have left Cleveland off there, and again, you and I are homers for the Cleveland market, but one of the more successful IndyCar cities over the years, the way that they had supported a race that was in the minor league champ car circuit, the one that was definitely the lesser of the two most of those years, Cleveland supported it pretty well, and it's not like IndyCar can afford to look a gift horse in the mouth. So that part of it there, again, we may sound biased. I would just say that maybe we're a little better informed based on living in the Cleveland area to know this. That's very weird to me that they haven't made it back on the schedule yet.
From what I've heard from people I've talked to is that they're having trouble finding sponsorship for the race.
Okay. Well, that was always an issue,
yeah,
too.
For so many years it changed from year to year, you know, who the sponsor, the lead sponsor of the race mm-hmm. was. So, you know, that's been my understanding. You know, it would be great to just have a full-time sponsor. You know, you tell me Roger Penske can't afford to, you know, have this race in his name.
Sure. And Penske's got a lot of ties to the area. So, yeah, I think more road courses is going to be something that we see come out of this. I think it's going to be more of a balance in that way between it's a sort of oval-heavy setup right now and putting some more road courses back in there because the road courses are inherently safer. You don't have the speeds that are being built up. So you're going to see some things coming out of this, and it's always interesting to see because Dan Weldon now, if we're looking at professional record, professional legacy, like Dale Earnhardt, it is on the one hand what he did on the track, what he accomplished, everything he did there, and I want to circle back to that as well. But in terms of what happens now, as with Dale Earnhardt and the Hans device and the other implementations that came after his tragic accident, to a certain extent with Dan Weldon also, this is what we'll think of. This will reshape IndyCar going forward, at least in some way, the lessons of what happened in his accident when they're better able to glean some of the causes.
Absolutely, and hopefully, like I said, IndyCar does learn from this, and they just don't try to make this just a thing of the past and just move on status quo. Because I haven't heard anything, not that I'm that well connected, but I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard about any change in the schedules, change of venues, you know, changes in the motors, because you know Dan Weldon, he was very paramount in the testing for the new car that was going to be on the track in 2012.
Yes, that's part of his legacy also. That's a great point. I mean, his legacy, you're right, involves that as well as some of the safety things that are going to come about as a result of this, and of course his own record on the track as well. It's really a three-pronged thing. You're right about it, and in that way, no, they have not actually come out with any of these things, Mike, because that's what the Vegas racetrack owner was whining about how come you haven't set these things in stone yet. They're reviewing everything right now as we're having this conversation. They're reviewing about the tracks, they're reviewing about the cars, you know, as well they should, because something like this, you don't want to jump to any conclusions. You want to make sure that you get it right, and ultimately under the circumstances, I mean, it would be disrespectful to him to do anything less than that. And also, by the way, it would be very disrespectful to the drivers because, you know, they can say what they want. You know, we're going to get back up on the horse, whatever. But I'll tell you what, next spring when it happens and you've had all winter to think about this, keep in mind this was the last race of the year that it happened in, they owe it to the drivers for their own peace of mind to let them know that they've done everything that can be humanly done to protect them. Obviously, we know you can never make this 100%. But you owe it to these drivers to minimize the risk as much as possible.
Absolutely. They've got to do their due diligence. And I'm sure the drivers and the team owners know what's going on more than anybody in the media.
Yeah.
So, you know, that being said, there's got to be some definite changes made. And like you said, I think you're right. Maybe we're going to see a restrictor plate, something of that nature. But changes have got to be made for the driver's safety.
They've got to, absolutely. And as we look ahead also, too, it's going to be, I think, a very unique scene next May when they come back to Indianapolis. And obviously the season will almost certainly be underway by then. The schedule hasn't been released, but typically they get a couple of races in before Indianapolis.
Right,
but
right.
Much like Daytona, that's the start of Daytona's the literal start of the NASCAR season. Indianapolis is the figurative start of the IndyCar season. It's when people really start tuning in, paying attention. It's the biggest race. And for a guy who wasn't a native son but really embraced Indianapolis like few others, keep in mind that was one of the places that you saw the makeshift memorials springing up at the Brickyard after the accident happened. I can't help but think it's going to be a month-long thing next year. It's going to be very unique and very emotional, and the likes of which I don't know that we've really seen a precedent for in recent sports history. Not just to have the defending champion who is deceased, but the defending champion who is so emotionally identified with one track. That's going to be weird.
Yeah, it really is. It's going to be sad. I'm sure there's going to be some very special ceremonies, mm-hmm. And it's really weird. It's, you know, you think about it. You know, I'm of the belief that everything happens for a reason.
Me too.
And you look at it, Hildebrand runs out of gas around the fourth corner.
Yeah.
And here comes Dan Weldon, who had no chance of winning. He was going to be second place, solid second place finish. Hildebrand runs out of gas. Weldon passes him for the win.
Well,
I mean, it wasn't like he was running away with the race. It was almost like there was a plan for this.
I agree.
And, you know, you look what happened. He got his ride. You know, he signed his contract to take over Danica Patrick's ride. He got that elite seat that there are so few of. You know, everything. I guess I believe everything happens for a reason. Hildebrand ran out of gas for a reason, and sadly, you know, Dan Weldon was taken away from us.
I agree, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt Dan Weldon is in a better place. The one thing in my life where I don't mind. If the certitude comes off as arrogant, I don't refer to anything with me as faith. I refer to it as awareness, and I am aware that Dan Weldon is in a better place. I am aware that everything happens for a reason. I agree with you on that, and I tell you what, Hildebrand, you look at him. I mean, there's the competitive juices of he's going to look at that race as the one that got away, although he's a very talented driver, and he's going to have other looks at it and probably cashes one of them in. So it's hard to separate the competitive part of it out from there. But do you think that losing that race got 1,000 times easier after what happened here? I mean, I gotta think to my – I mean, I don't know the relationship or lack thereof between he and Dan Weldon, but on top of everything else, he took Dan Weldon's seat. I got to think J.R. Hildebrand is probably a lot more at peace with what happened to him in Indianapolis last May.
You know, I agree. You know, and you don't think about those things until, you know, you sit back and you look. And, you know, I think he is. I mean, you know, right now Dan Weldon is, like you say, in a better place. And, you know, he's looking down at saying, okay, kid, your turn's coming.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of them, and I've been running through in my head some of the different scenarios for next year. How emotional would it be if this is the year that Tony Kanaan breaks through?
Yeah.
He has the reputation out there. I mean, arguably the best never to have won at Indianapolis. What if next year's the year? I can't even imagine that. I'm rooting for him. I certainly am, because, I mean, he was pretty much Dan Weldon's – wasn't he pretty much his best friend out there?
I believe it was.
Okay.
You know what this reminds me of, and, you know – I hope I'm right, is, you know, when Payne Stewart won the U.S. Open and he beat Phil Mickelson.
Yeah.
And he went and he hugged him and he says, look, your time's coming, kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully this is something similar to that. Because,
yeah,
you know, not too shortly after that, Payne Stewart was also taken away.
That's true. That's true, yeah. And, you know, this has been a bad year for that. I just put up a column on the FDHLounge.blogspot.com last week. A tribute that I put up there to a Patrice O'Neill, but what a weird year it's been for celebrities, really kind of taken before their time. I mean, you, Steve Jobs on down the line, Amy Winehouse. I wasn't a tremendous fan of her music, but I recognize her talent. And 27's too young for anybody. It might just maybe it's the end of the year, and you always think of this year as being unique and distinct from other years. But it does seem like this year, there's been way more of that.
Yeah, and, you know, you're right. It's getting towards the end of the year, and you always look back, and, you know, it doesn't hit you right away. But, you know, you see the similarities to something that's happened in the past. And, you know, boy, you know, I just hate to have such a downer conversation, you
yeah.
know, when we're talking about something that we love so much, like open wheel racing, you know?
We do, yeah.
And but, you know, Dan Weldon, you know, I'm sure he considered the FDH Lounge a friend. Like, you consider Dan Weldon a friend of the show.
Sure.
I'm sure he considered the FDH Lounge a friend of his.
Well, I would like to think so, at least in the sense, in the, as realistic as I can be about it. I think he came away from the conversation and felt good about it. We had a good conversation together. I have very little doubt in my mind we would have been able to do it again. With him, as we've been able to do. Once you establish a rapport with some of these people, it's a little easier to make it happen the next time around. So I think we probably would have gotten a chance here at some point, particularly as we would continue to grow and move forward and become more viable, that we would get to do it again there. And again, yeah, I mean, that's a great note to bring it around on, Mike, because it was one of those things, and I think I told you at the time how weird it was. We had the thing up on YouTube, but everything that we've been uploading to YouTube as far as our classic segments, we also put them up on our blog, and we also put them up on Facebook and Twitter. And I kind of stagger how I'm doing those, and I have a list. That was on YouTube, but that was the next one on my list for Facebook and Twitter, and I was going to be working on stuff that night. So, I mean, people can believe it or not believe it. I put it up that night, but that was going to be the plan anyways. It just wasn't going to be in an RIP kind of a way as it was originally envisioned. But I guess that's the takeaway I'd like to have from this thing here, is that conversation served, I think, as a good representation, a good window into the soul of Dan Weldon. At his moment of great triumph, he had won Indianapolis for the second time. Very happy family man. Second kid was going to be on the way. Very happy with life, and very nice to us. I think a perfect exemplification of how you treat your fellow man when you hear him in that interview.
Absolutely. I came away from that, you know, with a much higher level of respect for Dan Weldon. I always respected him as a driver, but you get to hear an extended interview, not just a 5-minute snippet. You take a little bit more away from that, and you know, he just came away as really just a down-to-earth gentleman.
Well, what I can say is that I take seriously the fact that he came in and that we were able to have a conversation that presented him and his career and his life in such a good light. And going forward, we're going to do what we can to continue to highlight things with Dan Weldon and to kind of keep his name alive here, highlight various things that are going on in the world of motorsports, some of the tributes and legacies there. There was a banquet last night in Great Britain along those lines. He won, it was a Lifetime Achievement Award, I guess, for his exploits in motorsports. And, of course, he was held in very high regard in Great Britain for everything that he had done, being a conquering hero over in America here. So he won that Lifetime Achievement Award posthumously last night. I'm sure there will be many things like that yet to come. And I am convinced, I'm going to reach out at a certain point in the near future here to his management, who had been instrumental in booking this thing, and not even in a self-serving way that I feel that we need to be involved in this, but I want to just recommend to them, the story needs to be told. I think we need to see a Dan Weldon story, maybe a movie about his life or something like that. It would be, the obvious sense is that, you know, it might be morbid because of how it turned out or whatever. It doesn't have to be. I'd like to see something about his life. I'd like to see something about him coming over to America, struggling through the early days, making it, becoming a champion, and again, what he was able to achieve at the very end. I'd like to see that, Mike.
Absolutely. And, you know, sports movies always are big over here. And,
yeah,
you know, right now, open wheel racing is not even on the same level as NASCAR. But I think the Dan Weldon story mm-hmm. is separate from a sports movie.
Yes.
Where it could be very successful.
Yes. And I certainly hope that his management, and they may already be working on this, but just as maybe that could be a small way to kind of repay the favor, is just to encourage them. And I've gotten good feedback from everybody I've talked to. They said that they would be interested in seeing such a movie. So, again, anything that can be done to continue to keep the name of Dan Weldon alive and let people know what a great racer, great champion, and great person the man was, the FDH Lounge is going to be behind that. And toward that end, Mike, although, you know, very sad subject, I looked forward to having this conversation with you because I knew that a conversation with you would be the kind of thing that could do justice to him And I'm glad that we've been able to do that tonight. Thank you so much, my friend.
My pleasure, Ricky.
Appreciate it.